Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. Excuse me, I am live 2 to 3 in the afternoon, but on this station we're live from 9:30 to 10 in the morning. I do two shows a day, and sometimes that's confusing for an old guy with a brain as old as mine. I have a half-hour show on the station where you're listening to me right now every weekday from 9:30 to 10. And then on other stations, I have an afternoon show from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. Same kind of show, live, call in. You can hear either of these shows live or later from my website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. And the program, if you're not familiar with it, is a live, interactive call-in show. You can call in if you have questions about the Bible, if you have questions about Christianity, about your own spiritual life or your spiritual journey, if you have objections to Christianity, objections to the Bible, or you're a Christian and you just disagree with something this host has said and you'd like to balance comment. All of those things are fair game right here. And we have lines open for you right now. You can reach me at 1-800-227-5278. That's 1-800-227-5278. And you can call me, as I say, with any of those issues. You know, I've never mentioned it on this program, and this is now beginning our fifth week on these stations. If you are interested in alternative views of the book of Revelation, there is a book that I wrote years ago. It's still in print. You can still get it through Amazon or wherever. I don't sell it. I don't sell anything. But you can buy it through the regular book outlets. It's called Revelation, Four Views, a Parallel Commentary by yours truly, Steve Gregg. And it is a commentary, verse by verse, through the book of Revelation with four columns. Under each passage, there are four columns which give four different views of Revelation that have been held by Christian leaders historically. Many people don't know that there are four views of Revelation, and that's okay. I didn't know that for a long time either. But about 13 years ago, I wrote this book, and it's still available, and you can find it in your booksellers. It is Revelation, Four Views, a Parallel Commentary by Steve Gregg. I don't sell it. Like I said, I don't have anything for sale. You can go to my website, and if you click on Revelation Book, it'll just take you to Amazon.com because it's just not, I don't do sales. But I do want you to know that it exists because it may be helpful to you. Many people have felt it has been helpful to them in sorting out the different views of the book of Revelation. Now, speaking of Revelation, we're going to talk to Abraham from Los Angeles, who has something to ask me about the 144,000 which are in Revelation. Abraham, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Hi.
Hi, I'm a third time calling now. I listen to your show every single morning, but I had a good question for you. I just actually myself found God, and I started reading the New Testament, and I'm in the book of Revelation now, and I was reading yesterday, and I saw the 144,000. And I just wanted to know, is that why Jehovah's Witnesses believe that that's the total number of people that will go to heaven? And why do they think that? And is it true?
Yeah, well, the Jehovah's Witnesses have their own interpretation of Scripture, and especially of the book of Revelation, that's rather unusual, and in my opinion, not very reliable. But the 144,000 are mentioned only twice in the Bible. They're mentioned in chapter 7 of the book of Revelation, and also again in chapter 14. And in my opinion, it's always referring to the same people in both places. Now, the Jehovah's Witnesses do interpret that to be them. They believe that the 144,000 is the number of people who will actually be going to heaven. Now, there are more than 144,000 Jehovah's Witnesses. The movement is much larger than that. And so what they believe that the 144,000 are special Jehovah's Witnesses, elite ones. They call them anointed ones. And that they will be in heaven, but that the other Jehovah's Witnesses will be on a perfect renewed earth. So they believe that some Jehovah's Witnesses will be in heaven and some will be on a perfect earth. And they believe the 144,000 will be the ones in heaven. I actually had the chance to meet one of their anointed ones and talk with him in his home many years ago. They know who they are. But actually, it's totally a fabricated understanding. The 144,000 in the book of Revelation are not the Jehovah's Witnesses. For one thing, they are Jewish. There are 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. We're told that in chapter 7. And not all Jehovah's Witnesses are Jewish. So we can know right there that their interpretation is mistaken.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's a good answer. Okay, sounds good.
Hey, I'm glad you found God recently and that you've become a regular listener to the program and caller.
Oh, yeah, I'm really glad. So I'm 25 now, and I'm just excited about it. I can't believe it took me this long.
Yeah, well, that's pretty young, but not young, not as young as it could have been. So it's good that you didn't waste any more time.
Exactly. Thank you, Steve.
All right. God bless you, Abraham.
Sure.
Thank you. Good talking to you. Bye now. Okay, let's talk next to Lisa calling from San Pedro, California. Lisa, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thank you. I wanted to see if you could discuss the difference between dispensational and covenant theology and your views.
Well, the reason that dispensational theology is called that is because dispensationalism teaches that there are seven distinct periods of time called dispensations, and that each one is characterized by a covenant, a different covenant in each case that God made with his people. And for example, they believe that when Adam and Eve were created, God made a covenant with them that they could be, live forever if they didn't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. When they broke that covenant, then there came a different covenant and a different dispensation. And according to dispensationalism, there are seven such covenants, seven such dispensations. And although not all dispensationalists today will say what the early dispensationalists did say, but it was originally part of that view that people were saved seven different ways at seven different times in history. That is, whatever covenant was current was also defining of the method of salvation at that time. For example, they believed that Moses and Sinai, with the Sinaitic covenant, began a new dispensation, which lasted up until the time of Christ. And that was the dispensation of the law. Now, they would say that people were saved by keeping the law during that time, because that was the condition of that covenant. Now, the covenant theology disagrees with that and believes there's only been one covenant of grace for all times. That is, God has always saved people exactly the same way, through grace, by faith. And that would seem to agree with what Paul said when Paul pointed out that Abraham was justified by faith and not by works of the law. And then he gave the example also in Romans 4 of David, who also lived in Psalm 32, which Paul quotes there, testified to having his sins forgiven without having done works of the law, although David lived under the law. So Paul seems to be saying that there's always been only one method of salvation, and that is that you believe in God or in Christ, and your faith justifies you as Abraham's did. Now, dispensational theology originated in 1830, and it has become the leading theological viewpoint of evangelical churches. I was once a dispensational teacher myself. I don't hold that theology anymore. But the things that our listeners may be mostly familiar with from dispensational theology that are distinctive of it and different from covenant theology would be the understanding of how the Jews as a race function in God's purposes today. Covenant theology would say that the Jews, God had a covenant with Israel that set them apart to be the people on earth who would bring forth the Messiah, and therefore through the Messiah, salvation. Remember, Jesus said salvation is of the Jews. And therefore, they have served that purpose. And now they, like all other people, have one obligation, that is to follow the Messiah. So that if they do, Jewish people who follow the Messiah are part of the new covenant, which is just the way that Jesus has renewed the covenant in the upper room with his disciples. And Gentiles and Jews together are part of this kingdom now under Christ. But that the Jews who do not receive Christ are not any more special to God than Gentiles who don't receive Christ. That is, covenant theology would suggest that God is not a racist, and he doesn't accept anybody simply because of who their ancestors were or what race they are of, but that God accepts all people on exactly the same basis, whether they have faith or not. And whereas dispensationalism teaches that God still, that the Jews are still God's chosen people, even if they reject Christ, and that they have some kind of God has a separate plan for Israel that's separate from his plan for the church and for the nations. And that is, as I say, that's dispensationalism. That arose in 1830. The church never believed or taught anything like that prior to that.
How did it become so popular now?
It became popular.
Why did it rise and grow so quickly?
It grew very quickly in England because John Nelson Darby, its founder, was an excellent Bible teacher and a brilliant man. He was an Anglican priest, actually, but he joined with the Plymouth Brethren and became the chief teacher in that movement. And he was the founder of this theology. He made it up. And so, or he discovered it, he would say, but in the Bible. But anyway, he was very influential in England, and many great Christians adopted the dispensational view, including George Mueller, Hudson Taylor. I mean, these people were dispensationalists until later in their lives. At least Mueller renounced it later on. But it became popular in America through C.I. Schofield in the Schofield Reference Bible. In 1909, a lawyer named C.I. Schofield published a Bible with dispensational notes in it, which he'd gotten from, you know, Darby's teaching. And that Bible became extremely influential. And then, before long, Bible schools were founded to teach dispensationalism. One of them became Dallas Theological Seminary. One became Moody Bible Institute. One became Wheaton College and, of course, Multnomah School of the Bible up in Oregon, and many other Bible schools were founded to teach the dispensational view. Because at the turn of the 20th century, there was not one Bible college in the United States that taught premillennialism of any kind. And so the dispensationalists are premillennial, and they decided to start some schools to promote it. And J. Vernon McGee, Chuck Swindoll, Hal Lindsey, many very influential Christian leaders have been the products of Dallas Theological Seminary, or if not products, at least professors there and leaders there. So those are many of the main influences that have made dispensationalism the key view among most evangelicals today.
Do you have a book that I could read that presents a non-biased view of theology?
Well, I don't have a book particularly.
You mean you could recommend of it?
Right. There are. I'd just go on to Amazon.com or ChristianBook.com, and just start looking up. Look up the word dispensationalism, and you'll find books for and against it. And you'd probably find something there. I've read many, many books. I don't know which ones I could say are the most unbiased. I would say that although I'm not completely unbiased, I do try to present both sides of the case in my lecture series, which you can download free from my website at thenarrowpath.com. If you click on the link that says topical lectures,
okay,
and scroll down, there's a series called God's, it's what's it called? It's called When Shall These Things Be? That's what it's called. It's 14 lectures. And I basically give the dispensational arguments and the non-dispensational arguments. I am non-dispensational, so my bias will come out. But at the same time, I was dispensational, and so I present dispensationalism as convincingly as I would have when I was a dispensationalist. So I like my listeners to be able to hear the arguments for both sides. So it's at thenarrowpath.com. Click on the link that says topical lectures, and then scroll down to the series that said, When Shall These Things Be? That's what you'll hear.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Lisa, thanks for your call.
Okay, bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Bye now.
Bye.
Okay, our next caller is, let's see who's been here longest. Well, Renee has been here longest from Pittsburgh, California. Hi, Renee. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. Great to talk to you again.
Yeah.
I'm calling because I was in a conversation with one of my Christian girlfriends a while back, and we were talking about the apostles, and up to that time, it had never crossed my mind that Paul was not part of the 12 apostles.
Right.
We agreed on all 11 except Paul and Matthias. She believes that Matthias is still part of the 12, and I believe Paul is part of the 12. Can you give me your opinion on that?
Yeah, I grew up thinking the way you're thinking now, that when Judas died or killed himself, that God had in mind to replace him with the Apostle Paul, but that before the other apostles knew of it, and before Paul was converted, they made a mistake and appointed a guy named Matthias, in Acts chapter 1, to be the replacement for Judas. And so I figured that, well, they just jumped the gun. They picked an apostle without being guided by God and made a mistake. And then that Paul came along and was the right guy. Now, that was how I understood things, but that's not necessarily what the Bible says. You see, the Bible does not indicate that there are only 12 apostles. I think that Paul and his companions were apostles, but they were not counted among the 12 because the 12 were designated to minister among the 12 tribes of Israel. And remember, Paul, when he first got converted, or a few years afterwards, he went to Jerusalem. He tells about this in Galatians chapter 2. And he says that the apostles in Jerusalem, Peter and James and John, those guys, they had an agreement between themselves and Paul that they were sent to the circumcision, that is, to the Jews, and that he and his companions were sent to the uncircumcision. So I personally believe that the 12 was a discrete group that primarily corresponded with the 12 tribes of Israel and they saw their mission primarily as reaching out to the Jewish people. And Paul and his companions were also apostles, but not necessarily of the 12. They had a Gentile mission that was separate. Now, one reason I think that is because the book of Acts, of course, tells us in chapter 1 about the selection of Matthias to replace Judas. And the book of Acts is written by Luke. And Luke was Paul's friend. Luke was Paul's companion. Luke and Paul were inseparable. Luke was Paul's biggest fan. And it's clear because he spent the whole second half of the book of Acts just talking about Paul and his journeys. But when Luke mentions the selection of Matthias, he doesn't in any way suggest that that was a mistake, even though his writing of the story was decades later. You know, I mean, the book of Acts would have been written decades after Pentecost. And therefore, when Luke wrote it, he had had much time to reflect, and so had the church, on whether Matthias was a good choice or not. And even though Luke was fully convinced that Paul was a very important apostle, Luke does not give any indication that Paul was supposed to be in that place that Judas had been. And when it says that Matthias was chosen, it says from then on he was counted with the 11 as an apostle, and he never really suggests otherwise. And in later chapters, in the early part of Acts, Luke mentions, you know, great power was given to the apostles to work wonders and to preach the gospel with boldness and so forth. And of course, Luke has already indicated that Matthias is one of those. Sometimes people say, well, we know it was a mistake that Matthias was chosen because after Acts chapter 1, we never hear of him again. But that's not true. We do hear of him again. We don't hear of his name, but we hear of the apostles. And Luke tells us that Matthias was counted among the apostles. So Matthias is heard from again, but not by name. He's out there preaching the gospel with the other apostles. We actually don't hear of the other apostles by name after that either, except for Peter, James, and John. So I think Matthias was recognized throughout his lifetime as the replacement for Judas. But Paul was probably far more significant than Matthias in that he headed up an entirely different mission that was much larger and had much more impact long term.
Well, my argument was that because when Paul said that he was chosen by God and not by man, and it seems to me that Matthias was chosen by man and not by God because they cast the lots, and wherever the lots fell, that's who they chose, and the lots.
Yeah, but they did believe that God was making the choice by the lot. You know, it says in Proverbs 16, I think it's verse 32. Mm-hmm. It says the lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is of the Lord. And casting lots was actually a way in which, in biblical times, God sometimes did make his will known. And that's why the disciples assumed they could use it. Remember, they prayed, Father, you show us which one of these two you have chosen to fill Judas's place. So, I mean, they could have been mistaken. Apostles do make mistakes sometimes. But at the same time, they believed that it was God, not them, that was making the choice. So it'd be, I guess, a matter of whether they were right or wrong. But Luke, who wrote the story, does not tell us that they were wrong.
Okay.
Even though he was a huge fan of Paul.
Consider what you're saying and see if I can wrap my mind around what you're saying, because I still kind of think it's Paul and not Matthias.
That's fine. We won't get in a brawl about that.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
God bless you, Renee. Bye now. Okay, let's talk next to Joshua from San Diego. Joshua, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Okay, my question focuses around the study of the origination and the compiling of the New Testament canon. I'm a historian by trade, and you know just as well as I do the value of primary sources and the way that certain secondary sources can get misconstrued. Now, I just want to know why, because the New Testament wasn't really developed until certain times after, you know, the Council of Nicaea and all these other things. Now, how do we know the books that are in the New Testament canon currently today are the right ones that we should be studying instead of some other Gnostic texts? Or also some of the more hypocritical or controversial books such as Titus and Timothy that are very patriarchal and some people interpret it to being very, anti-women in the church kind of thing, very legalistic. So that basically my question's about the New Testament canon and why is there any, why is it so the way it is? Why do we have...
Sure. Well, of course, as a historian, you know that we would not reject books because we don't like their contents. We would be more concerned about whether they're authentic, right? And the fact that some people have interpreted 1 Timothy, for example, as being, holding women down out of the eldership, and that has become unpopular in modern times, is not a very good argument against it being authentic, especially in view of the fact that its purported author is Paul, and he wrote 1 Corinthians much, much earlier, and nobody really disputes that Paul wrote 1 Corinthians, although people have disputed Paul's authorship of the pastoral epistles. But no one has ever disputed the authorship of the Corinthian epistles. And he says some similar things about women in the church in 1 Corinthians. So it doesn't really sound like Timothy could be ruled as inconsistent with Paul on the basis that it's inconsistent with our popular notions today. But as far as Gnostic writings, are you concerned mainly about the Gospels, the four Gospels, whether they are authentic and whether the Gnostic Gospels should be included instead?
Some of the Gnostic Gospels are very interesting, but, interesting is fun, but it's not God-spoken or inspired. But I'm really more concerned with most of the New Testament books besides the four Gospels that we have. Yeah.
Okay, well, 13 of the books were written by Paul, and they are, at least the early Pauline epistles, are the earliest books of the New Testament that we have. That is, Galatians and 1 and 2 Thessalonians were written long before any of the Gospels were written, or at least, well, I can't say long before, because the Gospel of Mark could possibly have been written around the same time, but most scholars would agree that Paul's writings, probably even including the Corinthian epistles, are earlier than our four Gospels in writing, so that Paul's writings are our most primary sources. Now, resurrection stories about Christ and resurrection sightings of Christ are listed by Paul in 1 Corinthians 15, earlier than the writing of any of the Gospels. So we have some historic testimony to the resurrection of Christ even before the Gospels were written. But as far as the Gospels that we have being authentic and better than the Gnostic Gospels, I would simply say that the early church had very good incentive to preserve the authentic Gospels and recognize which ones were authentic. These Christians were not, they weren't some kind of big conglomerate corporation that's making a lot of money. They were being persecuted, fed to the lions, burned at the stake regularly, meeting underground in the catacombs. This was not a group of people that had some kind of a hoax they were interested in purporting and promoting. These were people who really believed that they were on the side of truth, and they really had incentive to know which books were the ones that were really given to them by the real guys. And so their early opinions about it would be the most unbiased opinions about it I think we could hope for. Now, we have, of course, in the second century, like at 170 AD, we've got Irenaeus and we've got Tatian, the writings of Tatian and his Diatessaron, both around 170 AD, list the four Gospels that we have in our Bible. And they say that these are the four Gospels that were accepted as authentic everywhere in the churches throughout the world. And they said they didn't recognize any of the others, although they did mention some of the Gnostic Gospels as being in circulation, but they believe they were heretical and that none of the churches accepted them. Now, remember, when I say none of the churches, we're not talking about big cathedral, you know, political structures like they had in the Middle Ages. We're talking about churches that met in caves, churches that met in homes. These were little ragtag groups of people who were hanging on to Jesus for dear life because they were being fed to the lions. And they, like I say, they didn't have some kind of an axe to grind to try to promote some strange doctrine and start a religion. They were just, you know, they were just interested in the truth. At least I have every reason to believe they were. So I accept that the earliest witnesses, the ones who actually knew the apostles and passed along their writings, were the ones who provided for us the knowledge that we that the apostles wrote these things. Now, the canon of the New Testament was formulated gradually because there were a few books that the early church were not sure were authentic, and they withheld judgment for a long time. But they were books like 2 Peter and Jude and Hebrews and Revelation, which finally did pass the test, but after much scrutiny. The fact that it took them so long tells me that they were not quick to include something. If they had reason to believe there might be question about it, they wanted to have complete confidence in it before they accepted it. And the fact that they eventually did accept it, to my mind, indicates that the evidence was good in their opinion, certainly better than anything we could find now for or against it, because they were close to the time. Unfortunately, I'm out of time, and I wish we could talk about this more, maybe tomorrow. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We're on weekdays from 9:30 to 10 on these same stations. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to go to our website, there's many free resources at thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Talk to you again tomorrow.